Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. It's no particular secret that North Carolina has long done a poor job of meeting the needs and respecting the rights of people living with disabilities. Maybe, however, there are some signs of potential progress. Earlier this year, for example, a Wake County judge ruled that the state has been violating the law by maintaining a system that makes it easier for people with intellectual or developmental disabilities to be institutionalized than to find services and supports in the community. Recently, I got a chance to sit down with the executive director of the organization that helped bring the lawsuit, Virginia Knowlton Marcus of Disability Rights North Carolina. In addition to issues surrounding access to housing and community services, Knowlton Marcus and I also discussed what North Carolina is and should be doing to help people with disabilities vote and get properly counted in the 2020 census. Well, Virginia Knowlton Marcus, welcome to News and Views. Good to have you back with us.
It's great to be here. Good to see you again.
Lots going on in the world of disability rights. Y'all have been involved in some important litigation recently about North Carolina illegally segregating people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and putting them at risk of institutionalization. It's amazing. Here it is 2020, and we're still wrestling with sort of what seem like pretty basic issues here. But unfortunately, North Carolina still got a ways to go.
Yeah, we are behind the curve. It is the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act this year, and our cause of action was based on a parallel state law that requires people with disabilities to receive services in the most integrated setting appropriate, and that's not what we're doing. We're over-investing in institutional-based care mm-hmm. and under-investing in the community-based care that people want, that is better for them, and is less expensive.
Why do you think this is? Why can't we get this right?
Well, I mean, lack of political will, certainly. Change is hard. Lack of urgency, lack of vision, lack of know-how.
Yeah. All some those places factors. Have done a better job, I presume, around the country?
Yes, we are far behind the curve, far behind other states. In fact, we have more people going into institutions than coming out.
What's the solution really look like? You know, for people who are lay people who maybe haven't thought about this issue a whole lot, talk to us in practical terms what it means. How would our system of serving people with disabilities look different? And how would maybe they, as a layperson, experience that on the ground?
Mm-hmm. So the LME MCOs would have more...
Which we should say, because a lot of people are going, what? The LME MCOs? What's that?
Right. So the
this is the alphabet soup we've come up with here in the state to describe the local providers of services, right?
Yes, yes. Medicaid-based services for people with disabilities. The local management entities, managed care organizations... Right. are in charge of developing that provider network. And the provider network is lacking. So we have a number of problems. We have people who are in institutions who want to receive services in the community and can't get out because of lack of capacity. Right. We have people...
This is a person with perhaps has got developmental disabilities. They have limited intellectual capacity. Is that what we're talking about?
In many cases, it might, yes. In many cases, they might have an intellectual disability, but it's intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Okay.
Those are the plaintiffs in our lawsuit. But it certainly affects people with other disabilities as well. We also have people who are on a waiting list for services. They're mm-hmm. in the community. They really can't get services unless they go into an institution because of the 10-year waiting list for services under the Medicaid Innovations Waiver. And there's also people who, you know, are entitled to services under the waiver and are having a difficult time finding enough services that they need. And of course, there's other problems in the system where people are receiving a certain number of services that they need to be safe in a community and will receive an arbitrary reduction in those services without adequate notice, meaning an explanation mm-hmm. why yeah. their condition hasn't changed, just the number of hours of support they receive has gone down.
What kind of services are we actually talking about in a community-based service? Is it where you live? Is it the actual interaction you have with someone to help you organize your life? What does it look like?
Yes, in many cases, it's individualized. People will receive different services. It might look like supported employment, people who receive support so that they can participate in the economy.
Not just be in a sheltered workshop, but actually go out and work in a more traditional workplace with some assistance.
Exactly. Along with their non-disabled peers, as opposed to being in a workshop where the only non-disabled people are paid staff and
right.
everybody else has a disability. So we're right. moving away from these kinds of models where people with disabilities are segregated. It's a natural part of human existence. You know, we were going to have anywhere from 20 to 25% of the population having one or more disability. Right. We just need to figure out a way that we can all support one another in our communities.
So judges issued a ruling in this case, and what's going to happen next?
Yes. So we had the oral argument on both parties filed a motion for summary judgment, mm-hmm. and ours was granted, mm-hmm. and the state's was denied. So now the next phase is to craft the injunctive relief. Mm-hmm. So that means, you know, what does the state have to do to fix these problems? And so one is probably going to be more long-term development of a plan to mm-hmm. gradually shift the imbalance that mm-hmm. we have and move toward investment in community away from institutional-based care. And we're also going to be advocating for more near-term relief. I mean, we have over 12,000 people on the waiting list.
Good grief.
For services. And there must be some way to develop the community capacity to serve more people. Again, people wait about a decade for services. There was an article in the News and Observer about a family, the Brandon family, where they have an 18-year-old son who's been waiting. He has autism and he's been waiting 16 years to receive services. So, I mean, you can't make up for that. Right, the earlier interventions are so critical to a person's ability to achieve their life potential. So this really is an urgent situation, and we're excited now that we can, you know, get some traction. We also want to make sure that the community is involved to the extent possible in designing the system and crafting this relief. So we will be putting out information as we learn more, as we work with the court and the state to figure out what we're going to do.
We're talking with Virginia Knowlton Marcus, who's the Executive Director of Disability Rights North Carolina, and we're talking about a whole raft of issues that face the disability community in our state. Another issue that y'all have been speaking out on of late is the issue of voting rights. As we record this, we're recording actually before the March primary, but the issue of voting rights isn't going away even after the March primary. Talk to us about some of the work that y'all are doing to make our voting system more accessible to people with disabilities.
We have done a number of things to make sure that public policymakers are aware that people with disabilities are a large voting bloc, 20 to 25% of the population has one or more disabilities, and it crosses all lines of geography, class, race, gender, you name it. So we are a large voting bloc, and we have been getting information to people so that they can cast a ballot that is informed. So we have the most accessible voter guide that we have seen right now available on accessthevotenc.org. Mm-hmm. It's available in multiple formats, accessible formats, podcasts. It's in Spanish. And what we did was send a survey with questions that are of general interest, but also specific interest to disabled folks, and published all their responses. So most of these candidates did respond, and for the congressional offices mm-hmm. as well, mm-hmm. I might add.
So it's not just about how to vote. It's actual questionnaires mm-hmm. to the people who are running. Tell us what you think about these issues.
Yes, we asked some neutral questions. It's a nonpartisan, no gotcha questions, just basic right. information that voters might want to know. Published all the responses that we received. And there's also information about how to vote and voting rights. And we also did a run of 40,000 large print voter guides and disseminated those across the state to people who are in institutions, people mm-hmm. who are residents of facilities, to make sure that they would have the information they need about voting, and also to just create the awareness in, you know, the administration of those facilities that the residents there have the right to vote and should vote. And if they can't get out to vote, the vote can come to them, and they should contact their county board of elections and make sure everybody can exercise their right to choose their representatives. So we're excited about it.
That's great. Again, the website is accessthevotenc.org. Our time is limited, but I did want to get to one other topic. We're talking about sort of the interaction between people with disabilities and the government. We're in the middle of the 2020 census now, right? That's another issue that's coming up that's obviously of critical importance. And probably there are some challenges sometimes associated with properly counting all folks struggling with disabilities. Is that a proper assessment of where things are? And are there things we should be doing to affirmatively tackle this issue?
Yes, absolutely. So that's also coming up. People are going to be receiving their census surveys, and they should respond to those. If they don't, then, you know, they receive the door-to-door visit. But people with disabilities are among what are considered hard-to-count populations. So we need all our partners to help mobilize the disability community and just help educate people the importance of this survey. People might not know what it is and why they should take the time to respond to it.
Right.
But everything from, you know, who our representatives are to how much Medicaid dollars we receive to, I mean, on and on and on, depends on a complete count. So if North Carolina is going to get its fair share of the resources, we have to do a good job getting our folks counted.
Yeah, we were just talking, of course, about the issue that we weren't investing adequate resources in some critical services. And obviously, to the extent we don't count all our people, then that presses the amount of federal funding that we ultimately draw down. And so
yes,
seems obvious no-brainer. Well, our time is up very quickly. There's so many issues. We have to do this again real soon. I hope you'll come back. I know there'll be more for us to talk about. Thanks for all you're doing. Again, the website is disabilityrightsnc.org. That is the overarching website for the work of Disability Rights North Carolina. Virginia Knowlton Marcus, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much. I love being on your show.
Coming up next, a conversation with the physician leading up North Carolina's response to the coronavirus. Don't go away.